evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, May 22, 2017. President Salva Kiir declares another ceasefire in South Sudan.
I have now declared a unilateral ceasefire so that we can create an environment for an inclusive dialogue and to facilitate the movement of humanitarian assistance.
And South Sudanese judges vow to continue with their strike until all their demands are met. We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. President Salva Kiir finally launched the national dialogue process today by swearing in the steering committee. Ugandan President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni was at his side as chief guest at the event. Simon Waki Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
As the co-chairperson,
as a member of the senior committee,
impartial and bear true allegiance.
That is Acting Chief Justice John Gadwich leading the members of the steering committee of the National Dialogue Process, taking oath at a swearing-in ceremony at Freedom Hall this afternoon. The event was launched under the theme Redefining the Basis of Our Unity and a Sense of Common Purpose Through the National Dialogue. President Kiir says the main objective of the national dialogue is to end all violent conflicts across South Sudan, constitute national consensus, and save the country from what he terms disintegration and foreign interference. The president says the committee's work starts immediately.
I want the committee to conduct consultations as wide as possible to give the people of South Sudan the opportunity to air out their views and aspirations for the restoring peace to their country. The dialogue should start with those who are willing, while the committee continues to engage those who are hesitant or have concerns. The government stands ready to accept and implement the outcomes of the national dialogue process.
Elder Abel Alier and Angelo Beda were named co-chairs of the committee. In an effort to gain the trust of the South Sudanese people, Mr. Kiir directed the government's prosecutor general to review all cases of those who have been arrested or are under detention for political reasons so that they can be released. The president also declared a unilateral ceasefire for his army, saying they will only act in self-defense if attacked by opposing armed forces.
And this, of course, has been the call of many people in the international forums, that the ceasefire must be declared. And so I have now declared a unilateral ceasefire so that we can create an environment for an inclusive dialogue and to facilitate the movement of humanitarian assistance to famine-stricken areas.
Mr. Kiir says he also ordered his National Security Service agents to stop harassing civilians and opposition groups across the country. The president says the steering committee should consult with all stakeholders participating in the dialogue, including former First Vice President Riek Machar. He says his government is willing to safeguard any opposing group that wants to send representatives to participate in the process. Ugandan President Museveni flew this morning to Juba to stand by the president's side at the launch of the event. In his 35-minute speech, Museveni urged South Sudanese leaders to avoid tribalism and embrace unity as a critical step in restoring peace and stability across the country.
I salute President Salva Kiir for inviting all these stakeholders here and saying you discuss the problems that have afflicted South Sudan in the recent times.
Mr. Museveni called on South Sudan's leaders to embrace national interests rather than affiliate themselves with the tribal ideologies, which he called destructive to national development. And Museveni challenged Mr. Kiir and his government to stop paying loyalty to their tribal associations rather than national interests. He reminded South Sudanese leaders that war threatens the country's economy and chases investors away.
When I hear talking about Dinka, I don't know, the Nuer, these Equatorians, Shiru, where did you get the 99%? Was it one tribe? It wasn't one tribe. It was the whole population. So how can you let them down?
Several activists have criticized the initiative, saying if rebel groups are not invited to take part in the dialogue, it's a waste of time. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Judges in South Sudan say they will continue with a sit-down strike to demand for a pay rise and better working conditions. The judges announced the strike earlier this month. Spokesperson for the South Sudan Judges Union, Gary Raimondo, says in addition to their earlier demands, the judges also want President Kiir to fire Chief Justice Chan Rek Madud. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Juba.
Speaking exclusively to South Sudan in Focus, Justice Raimondo said since last year, judges have been asking the government to promote some of them and improve their working conditions, but none of the demands was attended to.
When we call for a strike, it was to address this issue. Because you cannot find in the whole world, unless if it is a panel. In South Sudan, 3 judges, 4 judges, 5 judges sharing one room. And this is very unfortunate. This is, in law, this is justice delay and justice denial. The other coin is justice hurried is justice lurid. So if justice hurried is justice lurid, means justice buried.
South Sudanese judges across the country laid down their tools early this month. Raimondo says more than 150 judges across South Sudan will continue with their sit-down strike until their demands are met. Raimondo accuses Chief Justice Chan Rech Madud of failing the South Sudan's judiciary. He says judges are calling on President Salva Kiir to fire him if he does not resign from his position.
The General Assembly of Justices and Judges on a strike declare on their meeting on Friday, 19 May 2017, declared unanimously to continue their open strike until the Chief Justice resigns.
It was not possible to get a comment from Chief Justice Madud. South Sudan Deputy Chief Justice John Gatwich says President Kiir has formed a committee to address the judges' grievances. He admits that the judges' strike is affecting the function of the other government institutions.
Justice system is actually interlinked with others, the police, the Minister of Justice, the prisons, the judiciary. They are interlinked. They work together.
Major General Henry Kwany Aguar, the director of the South Sudan's prison service, says the judges' strike has affected prisoners across the country. Aguar says the prison service has received nearly 500 files which need to be taken to the court, but there is nothing they can do about it.
The waiting files are pouring in daily. They are pouring in daily without investigation, without being judged, and then It is creating overcrowding.
Aguar says, as the line management, they can only report to the Minister of Interior, but they have nothing to do about the judges' strike. But they do hope the issue can be resolved soon so that they can avoid the issue of overcrowded in the prisons. Lona James Elia, a woman activist in Juba, says the strike of justice in the country have crippled down the justice system and have denied some prisoners their rights. She says this matter should be resolved soon.
It has affected those people who are poor in the prisons, who are supposed their justice are delayed. One, we know that the judges they have maybe a reason why they should strike.
Elia says she is aware that the country is going through economic hardships, but the government should look into the grievances of the judges so that justice system of the country is not affected and crippled down. Raimondo says the striking judges met with a committee headed by Justice Minister Paulino Wanawila and have presented their demands, but they are yet to receive a response. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
State officials in Budwe State are warning residents of Lirongu Payam not to take part in farming activities because of ongoing insecurity. Four people were killed last week in Lirongu by an identified gunman. Relatives of the deceased say their loved ones were killed by men wearing uniforms of the South Sudan Army. As Gift Friday reports for VOA from Kampala, Budwe officials call the area a hotspot.
Yambio County residents say they are feeling confused and worried about the recent unprovoked killing in Lirongu Payam on those who went to their gardens to harvest some cassava to feed their families. Wenese Onganda and Simon Dadio are two of the victims of the latest violence in Lirongu Payam. A family member of one of the deceased, who identifies himself only as Mbiko Yesu for security reasons, says his brother Simon left Yambio to harvest his cassava from his garden in Lirongu, where he was killed. Mbiko Yesu describes what he found on the way to his brother's home.
So we went there to Lirongu. On our way, we saw also one dead body on the road. As we reached Lirongu, we saw four dead bodies together with my brother. They undressed them to shoot them and kill them, and their body were already rotten. To see the dead body of my brother in such a scenario, I was so depressed, so annoyed.
He says his late brother left seven children and three wives behind. He says it was not easy for them to access the bodies of their family members because they were told Lirongu is a no-go area for civilians. Tito Paite, a man who says his brother was one of the victims, says those who were killed were not rebels, as suspected by government forces.
Those youths who were killed are our brothers and our neighbors. We, as a youth in the area, we are very sorry about what happened. Indeed, the deceased were not people from the bush or rebels. They just decided to go to their gardens to collect some food from their gardens for their family at home.
Tito says the young boy who escorted his father to the farm was the only one who returned after he was told to go home and deliver the message that his father was killed. He accuses the man in SPLA uniform of killing his brother.
It is our own soldiers who are doing this. How are we going to live when we are facing it difficult from the economic crisis in our country and we have food in our gardens? But when we want to go and collect food from our gardens, which are in the far places, but we can still be arrested and killed.
Tito says he worries about the future of the orphans left by the late, since he was the only breadwinner at home. Yambio County Commissioner Philip Ngangbi confirms at least three people were killed last week.
The report came to my office that three people were killed in Lirongu, and I had trying to find out what happened.
Ngangbi says in cases like this, it is difficult to identify the killers because there are so many unknown gunmen in the area. The commissioner is encouraging local residents to wait for the government to secure the Payam before residents access their farms or ask local authorities for help. Budwe State Police Commissioner Major General James Mande Enoka says this is the first deadly attack in the area since January. Major General James Mande says Budwe State has seen relatively calm since the arrival of the new governor 3 months ago, but describes Lirongu as a hot spot since police withdrew from the Payam late last year.
We understand that those still holding guns, there are less than 80 who are still there. So that one actually is called a hot spot area. And the hot spot area is being handled by the South Sudan Army, or the SPLA.
Enoka says all major roads leading into and out of Budwe State are safe, with the exception of a few robberies by small groups of armed men. Budwe State Local Government Minister Jackson Ezekiel says the Payam is still not safe for people to access.
We are not encouraging our people to go to Lirongo because there are still handful of people or criminals who are in the buses. They have gone bad against the public.
Minister Ezekiel says there have been no recent rebel attacks in the area up until now, which he blames on few remnants of the Aero Boys. Last year, Lirongo Payam had seen fierce fighting between government forces and vigilantes who called themselves Aero Boys in opposition, who were allied with the former Vice President Riek Machar. Hundreds of people were killed and thousands displaced from their homes since fighting broke out in Lirongo Payam in early 2016. For VOA News, I'm Gift Friday in Kampala.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at how many people are displaced around the world. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what do you think about skin bleaching?
For us, because me, I'm black and I'm satisfied how God created me.
For me, it's not good because when we look at the disadvantages of skin bleaching, for example, skin cancer and several other things. For example, when we see people have bleached and the effects they have when they go under the sun, we look at it and we say it's certainly not something good.
I'm a black, so I don't need to change my skin because I am very satisfying for this skin exactly. I can even give them an advice. If you use those products to change your skin, somehow not good because it can even bring some permanent disease like cancer.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus. In 2016, there were more than 31 million Nilo displaced people around the world, mostly due to conflict, violence, and natural disasters. That's 3.3 million more than in 2015. The annual report from the International Displacement Monitoring Center says, overall, at the end of 2016, there was a total of more than 40 million newly and previously displaced people around the world. Jan Egeland is the Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, which oversees the center. He spoke to VOA's Adam Phillips in New York about the report.
The big figures this year are the following. In 2016 alone, nearly 7 million people were displaced out of their homes and to other corners of their country by conflict and by violence. On top of that, some 24 million people were displaced by natural disasters. Could be hurricanes, could be floods, could be lots of other forces of nature. Altogether, 31 million people, same as one person per second. So as we speak, many, many families are displaced, either by conflict or by natural disasters, in some cases by both.
How are you able to arrive at these figures?
Well, we have an able team of researchers in our Internal Displacement Monitoring Center in Geneva. And in the end, it's piecing together this picture from more than 100 countries, really. And the last few years have been horrific, really. We've had a much higher plateau of displacement, both by violence and by the forces of nature. So this has to be tackled. We need to put internal displacement on the top of the international agendas.
Let's talk about Africa itself for a moment. Can you give me sort of the big picture in terms of what your report says about the continent?
Africa and the Middle East are the epicenter of displacement by violence, really. Nearly all of the top 10 countries in displacement by violence is Africa or the Middle East. Generally, I would say Asia is the continent of displacement by natural disasters. In Africa, the top country was the Democratic Republic of Congo. It surprised even our researchers that they would surpass now Syria, Iraq, and other countries that have massive attention to the conflict. More than 900,000 people were displaced last year alone in the Congo, and it's continuing massively now in 2017.
What about places like Somalia, South Sudan?
Also horrible what is happening in Somalia and South Sudan. Actually, the number two country in Africa in terms of displacement, with nearly 500,000 people displaced, is Nigeria. You know, you have the Boko Haram violence. You have the counter-terrorist operations. Mm-hmm. There is intercommunal violence. There is a lot of forces at play. And it's, again, a forgotten and neglected crisis that hits and hurts the most vulnerable and the poorest of people.
Once this visibility is achieved that you wish for among governments and aid organizations and that kind of thing, what do you actually want them to do?
We need a lot of things. I mean, certainly we need a lot more funding, not just for the emergency phase humanitarian relief. We need to seek durable solutions. I mean, it's education, it's development, it's building resilient societies that can also, you know, sustain the shocks of nature and the shocks of internal conflict. We need a lot more diplomats being empowered to do a lot more to seek political solutions. Somalia and the Congo, more than any other place, you know, they're man-made crises. Of course there can be peace. But then the region, the continent, and the international level has to push in the same direction. Get men with guns and power to the bargaining table and not fuel the fire. And then we need general development. If a country is developed, it is strong, there is less displacement than if it's weak, poor, and vulnerable. We do this report because we believe in change. We believe that people will hear our wake-up call, that they will see that we need to revisit and redouble our efforts to bring peace and to bring protection of civilians to the Congo. We need to do more for northern Nigeria. We need to avoid that famine and conflict makes Somalia, that has had a positive development, unravel again. We can fix it, but we need more attention. We need more resources.
That's Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. He was speaking to VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Leaders in development, law, and politics have ended a meeting at the Hague Institute for Global Justice, where they discussed ways of protecting children and schools in conflict zones. The talks were led by Global Foundation Education Above All, or EAA. Among the participants were the Chief Prosecutor for the International Criminal Court, Fatou Bensouda, one of the advisors to education, Maleha Malik, professor of law at King's College in London. She told VOA's William Eagle that conference participants were critical of the UN Security Council, which has not been able to end conflicts and that threaten children's education. They also favored moves by ICC to consider attacks on schools and school children when investigating potential war crimes.
We want to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals, but our argument is that education is more likely to prevent conflict. And what we're saying is that the scale of man-made war and conflict nowadays is threatening education, which is actually creating a cycle of violence out of which societies, such as, for example, South Sudan, find it hard to break out.
Also, I understand at this conference there was some critique of global governance. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a very strong message by the leaders here, all of whom agreed. There's a letter that they signed. Three SDG advocates got together on a platform. Her Highness Sheikha Maza, Bint Nasser of Qatar, Graca Michel, who, you know, very many of your listeners will know, a leader from Africa, Southern Africa, and Faris Whitaker, who does a lot of work in Eastern Africa. All of them got together to actually make the point that the issue has now gone beyond just trying to invest in more schools. The rate of destruction is so high that foundations such as theirs can't keep up. And what we need is reform of the Security Council. What we need is for people to stop using their veto responsibly and to use the parts of the Security Council that bring peace and prevent conflict rather than trying to deal with conflict after it's broken out.
Any particular ideas on how the Security Council would be reformed? And is your program or the backers of this conference going to be lobbying members of the UN or interested parties to promote this reform?
I think we're not going to be lobbying individual state governments. I think what we'll be doing is to take a lead on thought leadership. We will be discussing these issues, and we don't have any particular commitment to one type of reform or another. What we are saying as an organization that's involved in the not just provision of education, but protection of education, is that what we need now is a joined-up approach where we make sure that the provision of education, the sustainable development goals, aren't undermined by the scale of conflict. One of the problems we've identified is that the veto in the UN Security Council by the Big Five is not being used in as responsible a way as we would prefer.
Among those who addressed the meeting was the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, Fatou Bensouda. What is the link between the ICC and protection of schoolchildren in civil conflict?
The Treaty of Rome, which sets out the International Criminal Court, deals with war crimes and it deals with issues like genocide. But what Her Excellency Fatou Bensouda has done is to take a lead on developing what's called the policy paper on children. And one of the things that her team will take into account when thinking about whether or not to bring a prosecution is whether or not scales of violence have targeted buildings such as schools. And that will have an influence on whether or not they think that the crime is grave enough to justify prosecution.
Also, a panel discussion looked at research on education in conflict conducted by your program called Protecting Education in Insecurity and Conflict. What new information does your research show? And does it point to a way forward for strengthening global efforts to protect children?
One of the things we know now is that the provision of the right type of quality education, not just education, but good quality education, which is high quality content, can make conflict less likely. It can make the length of conflict less protracted, and it can make post-conflict recovery quicker. And this is our dilemma, really. In the end, this is the vision we want to convey, is that we have the research now that shows that the failure to provide good quality education is something that is a causal factor in making conflicts worse. So we need education to break the cycle of conflict.
That was Maliha Malik, Professor of Law at King's College in London. She spoke to VOA's William Eagle. That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with a traditional Didinga song from Eastern Equatoria. This one they are singing about Lucia. Been listening to a test of a traditional Didinga song from former Eastern Equatoria State. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.